If you want to regain some of the money you've blown on the stock market, you may start by carpooling. Internet entrepreneurs see an opportunity in the high price of gas. Several new web startups are using online social networking to help people share rides. NPR's Kurt Nickisch has more.
Every weekday in Boston, Anita Horn does what millions of Americans do. She gets behind the wheel and she drives to work.
Typically, I'm trying to get in about 9 o'clock and trying to leave about 5 o'clock, which is rush hour.
Another day, another drive, always alone. Lately, it's gotten to be more of a drag, thanks to gas prices. Horn also feels bad about the carbon dioxide her sedan is pushing out of its tailpipe. She'd really rather carpool and split the impact of both.
That's a big jump, just right there, taking one person. And having one person in your car and having to deal with one other person's schedule is really not that bad.
So Horn signed up on a website looking for someone to share her commute. There have always been online bulletin boards, but now GoLoco.com and other new startups with names like eRideShare are leveraging the latest internet technologies to make even the smallest carpool connections.
We can be thinking about our travel in more clever and serendipitous ways.
That's Robin Chase. She founded GoLoco.
I think when we go to the grocery store, you bump into your neighbor and you think, how fun, how great, you know, you're doing a little bit of gossip, so surprising to see you here. When in fact, that kind of serendipity could be happening not by serendipity, but by plan.
Here's how it works. Say you're a driver. You post online where you're heading and when. You also give details like what you listen to in the car and what you want for reimbursement. Riders go online and check out an interactive map. If they want to join your route, you get an email, or they can place their own posting looking for a ride. Afterwards, each person can rate the other, helping other users get a better idea of what to expect. If you asked for money, some people don't, the rider pays through an online account. CEO Robin Chase says drivers are cool with the 10% commission GoLoco charges because overall, the service can really save them.
The total car cost, not just the gas costs, it really realigns when and why you're willing to drive.
But not necessarily with whom yet. Rachel Hoppe is with IDC Research, and she's an expert on social networks.
They succeed best with a passionate audience. People aren't passionate about gas.
At least not enough, she says, to sign up for a new service in droves to really get online ride sharing firing on all cylinders.
There's so much complexity in routes that you have to have a huge group of passionate people to really satisfy all the different demands that are out there.
And even then, there will inevitably be the same old carpool hassles when someone flakes or has a last-minute emergency and can't go. But the higher the price of gas climbs, the more people will be willing to put up with the occasional problem. These new websites make it easier for those people to find each other and share a ride. Kurt Nickisch, NPR News, Boston.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Renee Montaigne is on assignment. I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Leaders of the world's richest nations say they finally agree on global warming, and they're still facing criticism. The leaders known as the Group of Eight, the U.S., Canada, Japan, and the biggest powers of Europe say they want to cut greenhouse emissions. They want to cut them in half by the year 2050. But as they wrapped up a summit today, that plan faced dissent from developing nations. They say it doesn't go far enough or fast enough. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports from the summit in Japan.
On the final day of the G8 summit, leaders of eight developed and eight developing nations met and issued a joint statement. It pledged to combat climate change and advance United Nations negotiations on global warming. The statement set no hard deadlines or numerical targets. Still, Japanese Prime Minister Yasuo Fukuda called it an important outcome of the summit.
16カ国の首脳によります強力な
The expression of a strong political will by the leaders of 16 countries necessarily, I believe, will become a strong momentum to promote the UN negotiations.
But the developed and developing nations disagreed over the G8's proposal to cut 50% of emissions by 2050. A climate expert at the Union of Concerned Scientists, Alden Meyer, says that there were major problems with the G8 statement.
It wasn't an actual commitment by the industrialized countries to try to meet that goal. it was a commitment to share their vision of such a goal with the major developing countries and see if they want to play.
Yesterday, the eight developing countries, which include China, India, and Brazil, said that the G8 suggestion of a 50% cut in emissions by 2050 wasn't enough. They proposed 80 to 95% cuts by 2050 and 25 to 40% cuts by 2020. Alden Meyer says that targets for 2020, which the G8 failed to agree on, are in some ways more important than goals for 2050.
What really is the focus from a political point of view was what happens over the next 10 years and what decisions politicians make now that are getting the right kind of signals to business and consumers about the investments they make, the consumption choices they make, and how much pollution they put into the atmosphere.
Developing nations want G8 countries to take the lead in cutting emissions. Chinese President Hu Jintao said here today that his country was doing what it could to cut pollution, but a lot of its emissions resulted from economic development needed to ensure people's basic subsistence. Environmental campaigners generally agree. Max Lawson is a policy advisor for Oxfam International.
The average American citizen still emits four times more carbon than the average Chinese person. And also, the mess was made by rich countries, so it's their responsibility to clean it up. They've got to act first, and they've got to act fast.
Kumi Naidu, co-chair of the group Global Call to Action Against Poverty, said the G8 was showing a poor record of meeting its own targets, both in aid to Africa and climate change.
If we go with the G8's targets that have been agreed vaguely here, we could be looking at a situation in 2050 where, in significant parts of the world, the impact of climate change would have been completely irreversible.
Many observers are now waiting to see if a new U.S. administration, either under John McCain or Barack Obama, will move the U.S.'s position closer to that of the European Union and developing nations. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Rusutsu, Japan.
Now back to this country and to an experiment in alternative energy. Picture a desert landscape. In the distance, something shimmering. It looks like a vast blue lake. It's not a mirage, it's mirrors, thousands of them capturing energy from the sun, enough cheap energy to power whole cities. At least that's the vision of a new generation of solar entrepreneurs, as NPR's Kathleen Schalk reports.
A new factory just opened near Las Vegas, Nevada, built by a company called Osra, founded by a man named David Mills. Mills is watching robots use suction cups to wield huge sheets of glass. Osra is mass-producing 50-foot-long mirrors.
We have to, at peak production, deliver one of these every 8 minutes.
Osra plans to crank out enough of these mirrors to cover 4 square miles of desert each year, enough collectors to provide electricity for 500,000 homes. That's a city the size of Albuquerque. Other solar companies have the same idea. They've drawn up plans to produce enough solar energy to supply a state the size of California. David Mills says this is just the beginning.
Effectively, we're talking about replacement of the existing energy system.
Pretty audacious when you consider that solar energy now generates less than 1% of the nation's power supply. The problem up until now has been cost and reliability. Photovoltaic panels can convert sunlight directly to electricity, but they're expensive. So is the electricity they generate, and they can only make it when the sun is shining. Osra will use mirrors to get around these problems. It plans on making electricity the old-fashioned way.
We make electricity in this country by boiling water.
John O'Donnell is Osra's vice president.
We burn coal, we burn gas, and we split atoms to boil water.
Osra's power plants will boil water by aiming rows of its mirrors at specially coated pipes to make steam to spin turbines. And Osra thinks that soon it will be able to produce this thermal solar power cheaply enough to compete with coal and gas-fired power plants. The price of natural gas has skyrocketed. New coal-fired plants are controversial and costly as well. And O'Donnell says thermal solar power offers two big advantages: free fuel and reliability. You can't store electricity from photovoltaic cells because it's too expensive, but you can store hot water. To illustrate, O'Donnell unscrews a little thermos, the kind you might take to work. Then he removes the battery from his laptop computer.
This thermos of coffee and this laptop battery store about the same amount of energy. One of them costs about $5, one of them about $150.
Thermal solar power plants can use stored hot water to make electricity even after dark. Investors and utilities are keenly interested, according to Nathaniel Bullard, an analyst with New Energy Finance.
I think the sort of rational actors in the market have decided that this is now something that's going to go.
For one thing, utilities are under pressure. 23 states now require them to get at least some power from renewable sources. Roan Resch is president of the Solar Energy Industries Association.
Utilities are looking around and realizing we can't build enough wind in our state. We don't have the resources. We can't build enough geothermal. We don't have the resources.
So, he says, they're turning to solar. Utilities have signed contracts to buy electricity from companies planning 7 big solar thermal power plants in California, Arizona, and Nevada. And a lot more plans are on the drawing board. But there are no guarantees this will actually happen. In fact,
all of those projects are on hold.
Resch says that's because of what's happening in Washington. A 30% tax credit meant to spur renewable energy investments could expire this year unless Congress renews it. Lawmakers have been bickering about how to pay for this. The industry also needs big, sunny expanses of land. The federal government's got plenty of that. It owns the vast majority of states like Nevada and Arizona. But Resch says to use it, you need a permit.
The BLM has not issued one permit for a new solar plant in the United States. Not one.
Ray Brady of the Bureau of Land Management says his agency is working on this, but it's simply overwhelmed. In the past year and a half, it's received 125 applications.
If, in fact, we processed all of the existing applications that we have right now, it would be about 1 million acres.
He says that's 4 times the size of the tracts set aside for oil and gas exploration.
And it's brand new. We have not completed environmental studies previously.
And they want to study the impact on endangered species. Energy analyst Nathaniel Bullard foresees other potential hurdles.
You could build the most beautiful, perfect, carbon-free generating plant in the world, but without wires, that electricity goes nowhere.
To string them, utilities might have to get past opposition from landowners and environmental groups. Still, Bullard says, with enough mirrors, tubes, and wires, you could theoretically provide enough solar power for most of the nation. And that's not science fiction. Kathleen Schalk, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Leaders of the G8 are claiming success today on the issue of climate change. While meeting in Japan, the group of 8 rich nations pledged to work toward the goal of cutting greenhouse gas emissions in half by the year 2050. Environmental groups, though, were not impressed. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports from Rusutsu, Japan.
Poverty and global warming seem worlds away from the posh and green resort towns where G8 leaders typically meet. Today, the placid waters of Hokkaido's Lake Toya were the background as Japanese Prime Minister Yasuo Fukuda announced the deal on television.
We, the G8 leaders, agreed that we will call on the international community to reduce by half global emissions of greenhouse gases by the year 2050. We confirm that this long-term goal is right and necessary for the Earth.
But NGOs say that calling on the international community to cut emissions is not the same as actually agreeing to cut them. Tom Sharman is a policy officer with the London-based NGO ActionAid.
What they've said is that if all of the other countries in the world that are involved in the UN climate negotiations sign up to a 50% cut, then the G8 countries will do so as well, which is kind of what they've been saying for the last few years anyway.
The G8 statement doesn't say cut 50% of what. Prime Minister Fukuda said today that it was 50% of current emissions levels. Philip Clapp, deputy managing director of the Pew Environment Group, says it should have been 50% of 1990 levels.
World emissions have grown 16 to 17% since 1990, and that was the level that we were talking about a year ago. And now we're going to cut 50% from today's emissions. So this is a much watered-down target from last year, and it's not adequate to stave off the worst impacts of climate change.
NGOs recommend at least 20% cuts by 2020, but today's G8 statement sets no numerical midterm goals. On Africa, the G8 restated their commitment made in 2005 at Gleneagles, Scotland, to increase annual development aid to $50 billion by 2010. Cliff van der Linden is chair of the G8 Research Group at the University of Toronto.
So now more promises are being made in terms of water and sanitation, which was sort of the priority issue, with very little in terms of how are we going to pay for this, especially taking into account that the promises that were made in Glen Eagles aren't being funded.
NGOs reckon that the G8 will fall short of its $50 billion goal by $30 billion, and that shortfall is likely to cost many poor people their lives. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Rusutsu, Japan.
Now, some experts think that water will eventually cause as much conflict as oil does today. And if that happens, plenty of eyes may turn to an area that you might consider the Saudi Arabia of fresh water. It's the Great Lakes that string along the U.S. border with Canada. Those lakes contain one-fifth of the fresh surface water in the world. All the American states that border these lakes have now approved an agreement to keep that water from being diverted elsewhere. NPR's David Shaper reports on the Great Lakes Water Compact.
It's a perfectly gorgeous summer day, and I'm standing on the shore of Lake Michigan in Evanston, Illinois, just north of Chicago, looking out at the clear blue-green waters of Lake Michigan that appear to go on endlessly.
And as a kid, I used to think that.
Cameron Davis is president of the Alliance for the Great Lakes.
I used to look out over Lake Michigan and say, my God, it goes on forever. We never have to worry about this. But it's not true. This is a finite, non-renewable natural treasure. So what that means is we have to make sure that the water that we have stays here.
Davis says the Great Lakes Water Compact, signed by the governors of Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and New York, will do just that.
The compact, for the very first time, will provide uniform binding water use standards for the 8 Great Lakes states and the 2 Canadian provinces. First time ever. We've all been playing off the same sheet music when it comes to how we use this amazing natural resource.
Amazing, especially to those who have never seen the crystal clear blue waters and finely grained sand that have some Great Lakes beaches rivaling those in the Caribbean. But to many who live closest to the lakes, they're taken for granted. Something that happened 10 years ago changed that.
In 1998, there was a Lake Superior-based company in Ontario that proposed to take water by tanker out of Lake Superior to Asia.
David Nasker is executive director of the Council of Great Lakes Governors. He says that proposal spurred the Great Lakes governors to take action. In 2001, they agreed to a framework to begin negotiating the compact. By 2005, they had a deal to take to their state legislatures that first and foremost requires those within the Great Lakes Basin to take better care of it and develop water conservation plans and water quality standards. The compact also prohibits large-scale diversions of Great Lakes waters outside of the Great Lakes Basin.
It says clearly that the Great Lakes should not be the long-term water supply answer for any other part of the world or any other part of the country.
But shipping or piping Great Lakes water to southwest desert towns or drought-stricken southern cities is still far too expensive. Those who really want to tap into the Great Lakes water supply are cities and towns just outside of the watershed looking in. Jack Chiavatera is the mayor of New Berlin, Wisconsin.
It has been very frustrating to be able to see the lake from a couple of higher points in a city, but not being able to obtain the water.
New Berlin straddles the Lake Michigan watershed divide, meaning about a third of the city's 38,000 residents drink and shower in Lake Michigan water. The rest get water from underground aquifers, some of which are contaminated with radium. The compact allows communities like this to take water as long as they treat it and return it to the lake. But even before that can happen, the deal needs to be approved by Congress.
The chances of the compact passing in Congress are better the sooner it gets there.
Noah Hall heads the Great Lakes Environmental Law Center in Michigan. He says while Congress usually defers to the states in the region affected with most water compacts, the Great Lakes Compact governs a much greater portion of the nation's fresh water supply.
And as we're seeing droughts and water shortages in other parts of the country, I think that there's a legitimate concern that Congress might be reluctant to lock up the Great Lakes and prevent diversions to other parts of the country.
Hall and others say it would be best to get the compact through Congress before 2010, when a new census will likely cost the Great Lakes region anywhere from a few to a dozen seats in Congress, seats that will go to states in the growing and dry South and West. David Shaper, NPR News, Chicago.
There is another challenge facing the Great Lakes, the increasing threat of invasive species, and you can learn more about that by going to npr.org.
As we heard yesterday, this year is the 100th anniversary of the Model T, the car that put Americans behind the wheel. It was inexpensive, reliable, and the public loved it. The Model T and the other mass-produced brands that followed transformed the nation. Now another people's car is about to go on the market in another nation. It's India. The car is the Nano, priced low enough that millions of people could become first-time car owners, in theory. We continue our series on the people's car with a look at the many hurdles that the Nano faces. Here's NPR's Philip Reeves in New Delhi.
Now I give you the new car from Tata Motors, the people's car that everyone has been waiting for.
It's more than 5 months since the world's cheapest car was unveiled. Tata Motors presented the birth of the Nano as historic. Chairman Ratan Tata placed his baby car alongside some of mankind's groundbreaking inventions.
The same quest for leadership and conquering new frontiers led to landing a man on the moon.
Since he spoke those words, the world's been waiting with keen anticipation. It's heard how the Nano does 47 miles to the gallon and meets stringent environmental standards. Now it wants to see if the Nano will survive the ultimate test, the unforgiving roads of India. Nowhere is interest greater than here. This is where the people of New Delhi look for motorbikes at bargain prices. Hundreds of bikes are lined up on either side of the road. Everywhere you look, there's an oil-spattered mechanic taking a bike apart or putting one back together. Customers haggle, but the men who run this market are seasoned professionals. Om Soni has been in the motorcycle trade for a quarter of a century. He thinks the Nano costs too little.
What people will think if I have only a Nano? Nano is considered to be the cheapest car in India, and the person will also be supposed that he is the most cheapest person who buys this.
Tata Motors is taking direct aim at Om Soni's customers. It wants to sell Nanos to Indians who now ride motorbikes and scooters. Ratan Tata got his inspiration from seeing a man riding on a motorbike with his wife and children, including a baby. That's one of the most disturbing and common sights on India's lethal roads. The man wears a helmet. The wife and kids often do not. The motorcycle plays a central role in India's economic life. In the countryside, where 70% of Indians live, it fetches and carries like a horse. It travels roads impassable by car, connecting remote villages. In the cities, it delivers a multitude of commuters to work every day. Indians bought more than 7 million motorbikes and scooters last year, six times the number of cars. That's why Om Soni's confident the Nano won't damage his business.
No, never. It can never happen. I'm not going to throw my scooter away and take a Nano. For everything, Nano will not work.
The way we are receiving inquiries, the way we are receiving comments are quite mind-boggling.
That's Ravi Kant, managing director of Tata Motors, talking to the BBC. He says the Nano appeals to a new type of customer.
We could have never imagined that this person actually would have ever thought of buying a car or driving in a car. We feel that it's going to be a very big change in this country.
Per capita, the number of Indians who own passenger cars is still very low, just 8 in 1,000. But to the alarm of environmentalists, that number's growing rapidly with the rise of middle-class incomes. Tata's planning to start producing 250,000 Nanos a year, eventually rising to 1 million. The government's embarked on a vast national highway building project. City authorities are building roads, but they can't keep pace. 1,000 new motor vehicles are registered in the capital, New Delhi, every day, which can make getting around town difficult.
One of the best ways of getting through the traffic jams is to hop into one of these three-wheel rickshaws. They're even smaller than the Nano's going to be, and they're pretty good at weaving in and out. But even they get stuck sometimes in the traffic because the jams here are so dense.
People in the motorcycle business say it's much easier to use a bike. That's certainly true here. This is Delhi's old city.
The alley I'm walking down right now is about 9 feet wide. It is crowded with people. Most people are getting along on foot. There are occasional cycle rickshaws. One of them is just forcing their way past me now. And there's here comes somebody on a motorcycle. But basically, a car would stand very little chance of making any headway at all in this part of town.
Competition to the Nano is mobilising. Bajaj, in partnership with Renault and Nissan, is working on a car that'll sell at the same price as the Nano. The motorcycle industry will fight to keep its market share. And it's got machismo on its side. The bikes named in India have a masculine swagger. Avenger, Splendor, Passion. The TV ads show glowering young men with big hair and boots racing around doing wheelies.
180cc, 15bhp, solid muscular styling. Bajaj Pulsar. Definitely male.
The Nano is not definitely male. It looks like a computer mouse on wheels. Its name just means very small. Will it be able to compete? As it's a family car, much will depend on who makes the decision. Vida is a housewife in New Delhi. She says she calls the shots when it comes to buying cars.
70-30%. 70% is me and 30% he.
She's not particularly keen on the Nano.
Because of space. It is a small car. I like big cars.
The majority of Indians can't afford any cars, let alone big ones. Yet there's no doubt many of them do now want to get behind a steering wheel, even if it's a tight squeeze. Philip Reeves, NPR News, New Delhi.
Tomorrow on our series, The People's Car, we take a look at how inexpensive mobility has been marketed to Americans over the years.
Henry Ford and his lieutenants were really tuned in to the fact that you could build the best car in the world, but if nobody knows about it and the image is not there, you're not going to sell many vehicles.
That's tomorrow on Morning Edition.
Realize the stop, realize the go.